Up next, witches and warlocks of Massachusetts and some other paranormal great goodies for you in a moment. Peter Muse joins us, and we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we're back with Peter Muse, author with degrees in anthropology from Bates College and Brandeis University, has been exploring New England legends, folklore, and weird traditions for 20 years. He's been blogging at the New England Folklore since 2008. He's the author of Legends and Lore of the North Shore. Another book is called, of course, his work appeared in Sam Baltrus's 13 Most Haunted Crime Scenes Beyond Boston. Peter has appears as a guest expert on the Travel Channel's Mysteries at the Museum, Witches and Warlocks of Massachusetts, another one of his works. Peter, welcome to the program.
Excited to be here, and happy Thanksgiving.
You too, my friend. And you're living out there in the Boston area, I take it.
I am, yeah. Just outside Boston. I'm like 300 feet from the Boston border, I guess, so pretty close to the city.
My mother was born in Fitchburg.
Okay, yeah, more out west.
Yep, absolutely, and Worcester and all that. I used to go out there as a kid every summer. It's a great area. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, it's we've had a really, great fall here, foliage-wise. It was kind of late, and then it was really vivid for 2 or 3 weeks, and now finally all the leaves are finally gone, so it's we're heading into the winter vibe here, I guess.
It is. And winter in the New England area is winter for sure.
Yeah.
How did you get involved in all these weird things that we're going to talk about tonight?
Well, you know, I guess when I was a kid, I was one of those kids who was always really interested in mythology and folklore and things like that. So my parents, you know, always had a lot of books in the house. So we had books on Greek mythology, Norse mythology, Roman mythology, all of that sort of stuff. And I really absorbed that. I can remember when I was a kid, like, having a friend come over and dressed up on my Star Trek action figures as mythology. At the same time, I was a kid in the 1970s, and as you probably know, like, that was a time when a lot of paranormal and sort of occult themes became popular in the mass media. And so, and I had an older brother who was really into things like UFOs and Bigfoot. So we just I kind of absorbed it that way. You know, shows about Bigfoot, UFOs, things like In Search Of, shows about the Bermuda Triangle, all of that was kind of in the atmosphere at the time. So I kind of had these two streams in my head. I had like the folklore and the mythology, and I had sort of the paranormal and sort of the occult that was in the pop culture at the time. And so both of those kind of coexisted. You know, I went to college, got a couple of degrees in anthropology, studied like world folklore, world religions, mythologies, things like that. And then really, when I got out of college, I realized I didn't know that much about New England, like the place I lived my whole life. Like, I didn't know much about the folklore and the legends of this area. So I started to research, and now I'm still researching. Like, it's been a good 20 years, and I have not come to the end of what there is to learn about the folklore.
It's endless out that way. I mean, there's so much that we're going to talk about tonight. I'm glad we're on for a couple hours, but we'll also squeeze in some phone calls with you. This being, of course, the eve of Thanksgiving morning now in some areas of our time zones. Let's talk a little bit about tradition, Peter, and Thanksgiving. You've said that people used to dress up in costumes and go begging for food and candy at Thanksgiving, not Halloween. How did that all happen?
This is true. Well, New England was founded by Puritans, right? Puritans who came over here from England. And they did not celebrate most holidays that we celebrate today. So they didn't celebrate Christmas because they didn't think there was any biblical basis for Christmas. They didn't celebrate Halloween. That would have been viewed as a very sort of a satanic holiday to them. So they didn't really celebrate a lot of holidays. But they did celebrate Thanksgiving. So for the Puritans, often Thanksgiving was almost a substitute for Christmas. Sometimes it would be in November. Sometimes it would even be, you know, well into December. There have been records of Thanksgiving being declared like December 22nd. Because it was not set on a fixed date in the past. It would shift around. And so along with Thanksgiving, you think of like in England at Christmas time, people would go out caroling. And caroling, you know, in England was very different than caroling is now. It was sort of like people from the lower classes and young adults would dress up in costume and go door to door, often drunk, and they'd be begging for food and alcohol and things like that. So that tradition, which in England was attached to Christmas, came over here but was attached to Thanksgiving because there was no Christmas here. And so you see records from the 19th century of, you know, working class folks going door to door to their neighbors' houses begging for food, which they would, you know, they would use to have their own Thanksgiving feast. But also children of all social classes and all social groups would dress up, sometimes disguise themselves as beggars and things like that, and go door to door begging for sugar, begging for apples, begging for nuts, all of this sort of stuff. So this is sort of like a precursor to trick-or-treating because there was no trick-or-treating at the time. Interestingly, I mean, this was found up and down different areas of the East Coast, not just in New England, but it continued in New York City until the 1950s in some neighborhoods. And if you look online, you can actually see photos of kids in the 1950s dressed up in these sort of beggar costumes.
That's funny.
Thanksgiving,
why did it wane, Peter? Because of Halloween taking over, probably?
Halloween took the place, yeah, because that suddenly became the official time to trick-or-treat. It moved to that holiday instead once that holiday became popular in the late 19th century, early 20th century.
You had mentioned the Pilgrims. Of course, they landed at Plymouth Rock. It is a very old, old town. What's happening out in that region now? And then it has had some strange things in the hauntings and things like that, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Plymouth, like you say, is an old town. 1620 is when it was founded. So that's, you know, a good 400 years of that settlement there. So in addition to all the folklore about the Pilgrims, it's just has a lot of folklore about witchcraft, vampirism, ghost stories, things like that. I was just reading about a ghost account from 1734. This wealthy sea captain named Thompson Phillips built a large mansion in Plymouth up on a hill there. And he married the daughter of a well-known minister in Plymouth. Unfortunately, the sea captain, Thompson Phillips, he died at sea. He was swept overboard by a big wave as he was sailing to Jamaica to do, you know, trade.
Oh, geez.
Then his wife died shortly thereafter from smallpox. And so the house, this big mansion he built, was left to the wife's father, this minister named Josiah Cotton. And so Josiah Cotton was like, I don't know what to do with this mansion. He tried to sell it. The economy was bad. He couldn't sell the mansion. So he decided to rent it out. So he rented it out to probably like five or six different people. It was a big, big building. And these people kind of would set up in different parts of the building. Some of them were working as carpenters inside of the building and things like that. And so they were working there for a while when they started to complain that they were hearing strange noises in the building. And some people said the noises sounded like the groans of a dying man. And they would hear those noises coming from the walls. They'd hear the noises coming from the closets. And of course, when they opened the closets, there was nobody inside the closet. They would hear noises that sounded like a cane, like someone pounding a cane on the wall at night. But there was, of course, no one inside. So this is sort of familiar stuff, right? People still experience these type of things. Doors would open and close on their own, all this sort of stuff. And also, some of their neighbors who lived next to this mansion would see strange lights in the windows at night. Like there's a record of a neighbor waking up in the middle of the night and she sees a strange light moving around the attic. It's a blue light, which is kind of an odd color. She sees this blue light moving around the attic for like half an hour or more. So the next morning she goes over to the mansion and asks one of the people there, says, oh, you know, was someone up in the attic last night with a candle? And they're like, no, nobody was awake last night at all. We don't know what you're talking about. And so this house, this mansion, gets a reputation for being haunted, and large crowds of people start to gather outside of the house at night to try to see the lights or hear the groans or things like that. And the tenants all leave. They all move out. They say, we can't live in this haunted house anymore. Interestingly, the reverend who owned the house, this man named Josiah Cotton, he thought the tenants were lying because they wanted to break their lease. And so he took them to court to try to get him to stop saying the house was haunted because he couldn't rent it anymore because people were afraid to live in the haunted house. So he took the tenants to court.
Who would blame him, right?
Right, exactly. He took them to court for slander. So he took them to court first for like what they called the inferior court, which is the low-level court in 1734. And the tenants were found innocent. The people on the jury said, no, we believe the tenants. We believe the house is haunted. So the minister was like, ah. So they moved it up to the superior court. They appealed it. And at that court also, the court found the tenants innocent of slander. They said, yeah, we believe them. We think this house is haunted.
Wow.
So finally, the reverend just moved into the house himself with his family. And they lived there for like 5 years, and they reported no paranormal activity at all. And the house is still existing today. I don't think it has a reputation as being haunted these days, but it was haunted supposedly in the 1730s. So, I mean, there's a lot of stories like that from Plymouth.
1800s, there was a vampire story out there, right?
There was a vampire story there, which is really interesting. I don't know if you've read a book by a man named Michael Bell. He's a folklorist from Rhode Island. He wrote a book called Food for the Dead, which
Food
is about
the
New England vampires, called Food for the Dead by Michael Bell.
Is he still alive?
He is still alive, yes. Yes. And in the 1700s and 1800s, there was a lot of tuberculosis in New England, which is, as we know now, a bacterial disease. But at the time, people were not aware of what caused tuberculosis. So in tuberculosis, it's transmitted often, you know, in small enclosed spaces. So it will go through families, right? So if, you know, one son gets tuberculosis, then maybe the father gets tuberculosis and the mother gets tuberculosis, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in the 1700s and 1800s, there was a belief in parts of New England that if somebody died from tuberculosis, the first person dies of tuberculosis, and then they're buried. And then, you know, another one of their relatives starts to get tuberculosis. There was this idea that the first person who died from the disease was feeding on their family members and from the grave, somehow like draining their life force. And so there were a few ways to kind of remedy this situation. And the most gruesome one is that you were supposed to dig up the body of the person, the first person who had died from tuberculosis in the family. And if they kind of looked like their corpse was undecayed, like it was, you know, fresh and rosy-cheeked and all this stuff, well, that was a clear sign that they were indeed feeding on their family's life force. And then, this is the gross part, you would cut out their liver and their lungs, burn them to ashes, and then the sick people in the family were supposed to either eat or drink those ashes.
Oh, geez.
This is supposed to kind of cure the tuberculosis. I don't think it had a great success rate, to be honest, but they had no other medical options at the time. The other option, which was less gruesome, is that, you know, you unearth the body of this tuberculosis vampire, basically. And it's, you know, fresh face, and okay, clearly this vampire is feeding on the family. Then you just have to turn the vampire face down. You don't have to cut out his lungs or liver. You just turn it face down so it's facing the earth rather than facing up. So apparently, like, directing its attention downward prevents it from feeding on the family members. So in 1807, there was supposedly a case in Plymouth, Massachusetts, where a large family of, like, supposed to be like something like 14 children plus a mother and a father. And tuberculosis was just, like, going through this.
Oh, it was rampant, wasn't it?
Rampant, yeah, going through the family like crazy. And so it was down to, like, one son was left and the mother. And so their neighbors are like, you know, we have to do something about this. We have to help you out. And so they dug up the body of one of the people who died earlier that they assumed was the vampire. And they saw that she was, you know, had, you know, rosy cheeks and looked like she was asleep and not dead. And so they assumed, okay, she is the vampire. And so they flipped her body over face down so she wouldn't feed on her family anymore. It didn't work. I mean, they documented that it didn't work. Supposedly just seeing his sister's dead body was like too much of a shock for the one surviving son. So he like died a week later. And then the mother just lived for one more year before she passed away.
Wow.
But interestingly, that appeared in a newspaper in 1822. Someone wrote in to say, I've seen this in Plymouth, Massachusetts. They're so primitive and backwards up there in Massachusetts. It was like a Philadelphia newspaper.
After the break, Peter, I want to talk about your book, Witches and Warlocks in Massachusetts. But there are a lot of other things that are tied into Thanksgiving. Like, where did the breaking of the wishbone for luck come about?
That's a good one. Supposedly, and, you know, take it with a grain of salt, I guess, some people have dated this all the way back to the ancient Etruscans, who were the people who lived in Italy before the Romans took over.
That goes Italy. Way back.
Way back, right? Like before, I don't know, what, 500 BC or something like that. The Etruscans, the Greeks, the Romans, all the people kind of in that part of the Mediterranean put a lot of importance into birds, right? Like particularly for fortune telling. Like you'd open up the entrails of a bird to kind of read the future, or the flight of birds in the sky could help you understand what might be happening to you in the, you know, in the next week or so. And so, according to some folklorists, the wishbone, which was called the furcula, which means the little fork because of its shape, that bone had particular power in birds. Perhaps that was some of the power that, you know, was used in the fortune telling with birds, this little bone called the furcula. And so, you know, having a furcula, a wishbone, was considered a lucky thing, like this is a lucky bone to have. And so that supposedly the wishbone belief dates back to the ancient Etruscans. And then as you move up to, I think the 1700s in England is where they first find like breaking the wishbone, where people are kind of fighting over who gets the luck, right? Who gets the power of this magic bird bone? And so that dates back to at least the 1700s in England. So whoever, you know, gets the biggest part of the bird bone is the person who gets the luck from that magic bone.
And didn't they eat goose more than turkey in those days?
They would have, right? If you are like in England, it would have been goose more than turkey.
Yeah, I remember that from A Christmas Carol. He went to the store to get goose for Christmas, remember?
Right, exactly. I mean, here in like New England, it was more turkey, but they all have the same bone. So, and the bone, the folklore about the furcula is not specifically about turkeys. It's like any bird that has that breastbone, that kind of forked bone, will do. So you can do it with a chicken, I guess, or a squab, whatever you're eating.
Does it work?
I don't know. I'm a vegetarian myself, so I haven't done it in a while. So if you do it this year, let me know how it goes for you.
Pie crust and apple peels or some kind of love magic? What were they?
Oh, sure. So there was a lot of folk magic in the past, right? I mean, there's still folk magic around now. People read tarot cards or experiment with crystals and things like that. But, you know, in the 19th century or earlier, people just didn't have all those material objects the way we have them now. And so often you would just do the folk magic with whatever you had on hand. And so a lot of the magic was about love and figuring out who you would marry. And so, for instance, if you are peeling an apple, like to make a pie, ideally you should peel the apple so all the peel comes off in one long piece. And then you're supposed to throw the apple peel over your shoulder onto the floor. When you turn around and look at the shape of that apple peel, it's supposed to tell you, it should form the first letter of the person that you're going to marry if you're an unmarried person. So I haven't tried it myself, but that's another one of these old folk stories. Also, there's a slightly spookier one that if a young woman wants to figure out who she's going to marry, she should take an apple and a candle, and at midnight she should stand in front of a mirror and eat the apple. And there's like a little chant she says, something like, whoever wants to marry me, come and share this apple with me, or something like that.
Jeez.
This apple staring into the mirror. And then she's supposed to see in the mirror the person who is going to marry her.
That's weird. A little Adam and Eve almost, it sounds like.
You're right. Yeah, definitely. Also, it's a little spooky, right? Staring into mirrors at midnight is not like the most comforting thing always. You know?
Exactly. We're going to take a quick break, Peter, and come back and talk about your work, Witches and Warlocks of Massachusetts. Peter's website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We'll take calls with him in our last hour here on Coast to Coast, so get ready. We will be right back in a moment on Coast to Coast. But he is an incredible person when it deals with anthropology, and he's got that kind of experience in that older town of New England area where everything just seems to be a little more stranger and spookier than most parts of the country. So we'll be back to talk about witches and warlocks of Massachusetts next. Next hour, we'll take your special calls with Peter Muse as we talk about the haunted areas of New England this Thanksgiving. So make sure you're part of the program. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie, along with Peter Muse. Don't forget, we will have a live program for you on Thanksgiving night, so make sure you're part of the program. One of Peter's works includes Witches and Warlocks of Massachusetts. And as we dive into this, Peter, tell me how you came to write this book.
Sure. You know, there's a lot of witch folklore in Massachusetts. You know, when the Puritans came over from England, they brought over their folklore with them. They brought a lot of folklore about witches, the devil, and ghosts. So those are kind of their main folklore categories. So, you know, when I was studying local folklore, I kept coming upon all these different witch stories. And I really wanted to have all the witch stories in one place. Like, I kept looking for the book that would have, like, every witch story so I could just reference it. I couldn't find that book, so I ended up just basically writing the book I wanted to see. So I just put as many witch stories as I could find into the book. So it's about 70 different historical accounts, legends, and sort of paranormal encounters involving witches in there, plus a couple chapters just about the Salem witch trials. So if you're interested in witches, I think it's a good book to pick up.
What did you think of the Salem witch trial?
So Salem witch trials, you know, well, first of all, I have to say when I'm talking about witches, I'm not talking about modern witches in terms of, you know, Wiccans or people who honor the earth or work with crystals or herbs or things like that. Like, that's a modern thing. I'm not talking about. I'm sort of talking about the traditional definition of a witch, which is someone who uses magic to harm another person.
Like the Wizard of Oz witch, that kind of
exactly.
Witch.
Exactly. Yes, Hansel and Gretel witch, like that type of witch. The Salem witch trials were just a big tragedy. You know, 19 people were executed. That's 14 women and 5 men were executed. And there was one man who was crushed to death while being tortured. And several people also died in prison. And over 150 people were accused of being witches in that. So often a lot of people, if they do genealogical research, will find out they were related to one of the people who were accused of being a witch in Salem. So it was sort of, there had been witch trials in Massachusetts before that. That was not the only witch trial here. There had been 5 other women executed between 1648 and 1692.
Oh, well, they burned them at the stake, right?
They were not burned. They hanged witches here in Massachusetts. It was sort of the English tradition was to hang criminals, so they would hang the witches here. They didn't burn them.
Jeez.
So it was, they were, and there was just, there were like something like 83 trials involving witchcraft in New England before the Salem witch trials even happened. Most of those were, you know, people were found innocent or they didn't go very far, but there were 5 women who were executed before Salem. And so it's, you know, it's complicated. A lot of it was like, often there were people who were unpopular for one reason or another with their neighbors, often had to do with sort of gender roles and the role of women in society at that time. I think the Puritan society was very hierarchical, and sort of, you know, older men were at the top and younger women who were unmarried were sort of at the bottom. And so women who didn't fit into the traditional gender roles often found themselves accused of being witches.
How did they accuse them, Peter?
Sure. So this, let's give an example. Let's say, you know, I'm a Puritan. I'm living here in Boston. And I have an argument with a neighbor of mine. Let's say the woman next door comes over and demands that I give her some firewood because she doesn't have any firewood. And I say, no, I don't have enough firewood for you. She walks off, she's muttering, she's like, rah, 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 right? I think, oh, that's kind of odd. The next day, let's say, you know, my cow doesn't give any milk. Then the day after that, my child gets sick. And the day after that, you know, one of my chickens dies mysteriously. I'm like, okay. Then
so you got a rash of bad luck or something.
Right, and who do I blame? I blame the person I just had the argument with who walked away muttering, who probably it might be an unpopular person in the village anyway, because maybe she's too loud, she's too argumentative, she's too flashy a dresser, whatever the thing is. And so then if other neighbors also have similar things happen to them after arguing with that woman, we think she might be a witch, in which case we would go to the magistrates or the judges in town and say, you know, we think this person is a witch, and then there would be an actual trial where this person would be put on the stand, and people would testify, you know, with the things that had happened to them, and try to convince the judges and the jury that this person was a witch.
And how many people made up those stories, Peter, because they didn't like the person?
A lot. A lot. I think, you know, if you look at the Salem witch trials, huge numbers of people were accused. A lot of them were the political enemies of one family called the Putnam family. they were sort of the dominant political family in Salem Village. So a lot of those people were accused of witches were the enemies of the Putnams or enemies of the Putnams' allies. And interestingly, you know, after the Salem witch trials ended, a lot of the people who accused people of witchcraft or confessed to being witches themselves said, you know, we confessed or we accused people because we were afraid of being tortured. We were afraid of going to jail. We were afraid that they would confiscate our property. So we did what we had to do, but we weren't really witches, and we accused people falsely. So there are quite a few cases of people saying they accused people falsely. There was a famous person in the Salem witch trials, a slave named Tituba. She was a slave in the home of Samuel Parris, who was the reverend in Salem Village. And she was one of the first people to, she was accused of being a witch, and then she also accused other people of being a witch, basically to save her skin. And
she ratted on them. You're basically saying she ratted on them.
She did. And then when the trials were over, someone, you know, went to jail where she was and talked to her. And she said, you know, I did this because Samuel Parris, the reverend, he beat me viciously unless I would accuse other people of being witches.
Oh, my gosh.
So, like, you know, there was a lot of politics behind it that was leading to these huge numbers of people being accused of witches. And plus the judges who were overseeing the Salem trials, who, you know, some of them legitimately believed there were witches in Massachusetts, they made some decisions that allowed the Salem trials to really grow to this huge size. And one of them was that anybody who pled guilty and named other witches, they were not hanged. So like if George, you're accused of being a witch, you go on trial, you would say, oh, I'm guilty, and here are some other people who are witches as well, like you.
Peter's a witch. Peter's a warlock.
Peter's a witch.
Yeah, all that
right,
stuff.
Exactly, right? So you would be saved. You might go to jail, but you wouldn't be executed. But then if someone was put on trial and said they were innocent and basically told the truth and said, you know, I'm not a witch. I'm innocent. I don't know what you're talking
God.
About. Those were the people who were hanged. So the people who told the truth and said they were innocent were the people who were executed, whereas the people who basically lied to save themselves. Those are the people who lived. So it's kind of a weird, mixed up, reversed version of how justice should operate.
The paranoia must have been incredible.
Yes, right? It was terrible. And finally, there were always some people who were opposed to it, because it went on for about a year, the Salem trials, like probably 10 months. And there were some ministers in Massachusetts who kept saying, you know, this is crazy. There can't be this many witches here. Something's wrong here. There were some political leaders who said the same thing. But really, it was not until the late fall of 1692, when the governor's wife was accused of being a witch, that everything was shut down. The governor's like, yep, no, we're shutting this down. You accused my wife of being a witch, and I'm going to listen to these other ministers and these other people who've been telling me that this is all BS, basically.
Well,
when it was shut down.
Obviously, how many people did you say were killed?
19 people were executed, and one person was killed during torture.
And I would assume all 19 were innocent because they weren't what we call witches.
Correct. They were not witches. They were not, right. There were no witches in Salem.
Unbelievable. And it took the governor's wife to be accused to stop all of this.
Yeah, that was the last straw, I think. That's when he said, you know what, I should listen to these other people and not the crazy folks who are running these trials.
It must have been horrible for family members who lost their loved ones this way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and after the trials ended, there were still people in Salem who were, you know, had seen their relatives executed, you know, and living next to the people who have falsely accused their neighbors of being witches. And it caused a lot of tension. A lot of people in Salem actually moved out. They moved to Ashland and Framingham, which are kind of west of Salem, and there's an area there called Salem End Road, which is where a lot of the basically refugees from Salem settled. And there's some caves there, some small caves called the Witch Caves, because supposedly some of these refugees from Salem slept in these caves before they were able to build their houses. So they kind of, you know, sheltered in these caves while they're building their permanent homes there. And one of their houses is still there, this I'll say the Elizabeth Clace house. It's an incredibly old house, but it was built by a refugee from Salem after the trials ended.
What is it about Salem that created all this activity about witches? Why not other areas in the New England area?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it had something to do with Salem and something to do with the time as well. So Salem was, at the time, it was a pretty big geographic area. So there was Salem Town, which is like the prosperous kind of port part of Salem, which is right by the harbor, merchants and fishermen and that sort of stuff. Then further inland was this smaller place called Salem Village. And that's where the witch trials really started, with Salem Village. And people in Salem Village had a lot of political division. A lot of them wanted to break away from Salem Town and form their own community. But other people in Salem Village wanted to stay connected to Salem Town because it was the richer part of the area. So there's this political fighting there going on. So it was kind of a fractious little village. It was only like 90 households, but there were a lot of infighting. And they had a lot of trouble keeping ministers. Like, ministers would come, and a minister was very important at this time. But ministers would come, they'd stay for a year or two, they'd quit. The ministers would come, the people would refuse to pay them because they didn't like them. So this went on and on. So finally they got this minister, Samuel Parris, and he had failed at being a merchant. He had failed at running a plantation. Like, he had just flopped in a bunch of other careers. So this was his last chance. So he was a minister in Salem Village, which was this politically fraught place. At the same time, so in the 1690s, the Puritan colonies were under attack by the Native Americans, primarily up in Maine and New Hampshire, but also in the western part of the state. And so, you know, the Native Americans basically wanted their land back, and they were also allied with the French Canadians. And so they were burning the English settlements in Maine and New Hampshire and just, you know, massacring the people up there. So a lot of refugees from Maine and New Hampshire fled south, and they were in Salem. And these people were telling these horrible stories of, you know, seeing buildings burned and people being tortured and, mm-hmm. you know, killed and all this stuff. And the Puritans really thought that this was the devil's attempt to overthrow the Puritan colony. They didn't see it in a purely political sense. They saw it in a religious sense. So they're like, the devil is trying to overthrow our colony.
Working through the witches, I guess.
Yeah, so, you know, working through the witches, and so they thought it was the moment. People were stressed by the Native American attack, they were stressed by the politics, and so they were just looking for somebody to blame, somebody they could, you know, act out on. So they turned on themselves, basically.
What is it about New England that makes it stranger than other parts of the country?
It's a good question. You know, I feel like if you look at the three major horror writers, the three most important horror writers in the world, all came from New England. So you have Edgar Allan Poe, who was born in Boston. He grew up in Boston. He lived here until he was a young man. Then he left because it was too uptight and conservative. So he went south. So you have him. Then you have H.P. Lovecraft, who's kind of a problematic writer, but a very influential writer, grew up in Rhode Island. And then you, of course, have Stephen King, who lives in Maine and is born in Maine. So those three all came from New England. So there is something here, I think, that inspires people that is a little weirder than maybe other parts of the country. I think part of it is that it's just an older part of the United States. And, you know, when the Puritans came over from England and settled here, they came over in the early 1600s. So, you know, Plymouth, as we mentioned, is 1620 was when it was founded. Salem founded in 1626, Boston founded in 1630. So these are old places for the United States. And those Puritans who came over, like, that's the Renaissance, really, when they came. These are folks who could have, you know, seen Shakespeare's plays performed live on stage for the very first time. Like, oh, yeah, I saw the premiere of The Tempest, you know, now I'm going to go set up a colony in New England. Like, it was a very different worldview. It's like a magical worldview. Versus you think of people like Benjamin Franklin, who is much more scientifically minded, but 100 years earlier, it was a much...
You still there? I think I've lost you. He is gone. So we'll get Tom to get him back in and find out where we can get you back. Let me try one more time. Peter, you there? Nope. Okay, we'll get Tom to get you back on, and we're going to have calls with him next hour. But he's been talking about legends and mysteries and folklore and some of the strange things going on in New England, to be sure. And his books include Witches and Warlocks of Massachusetts, Legends and Lore of the North Shore, Magical Folk of British and Irish Fairies. Those things are fascinating, too. And then Real Witches of New England. he's put a lot of that together, and truly remarkable. Remarkable indeed. Peter Muse, his website, newenglandfolklore.blogspot.com, which is linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. And we should be able to get him back on, and let's give him a try. Peter, you there?
I am here. Sorry, I think I hung up on myself.
Oh, is that what happened? I thought maybe your battery died on you or something like that.
No, sorry, I must have hung up on myself. Sorry about that.
You missed a call where somebody called you a witch.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Oh, darn it.
I'm kidding.
Okay. But yes, I hope so.
But well, we were talking about the area of New England, what makes it so strange, and it is truly a bizarre place, isn't it?
There's a lot of weird folklore here. There really is a lot of weird folklore. And I'm not sure, again, like part of it is because we have more folklore to be weird about. You know what I mean? We have 400 years of history where you can just look at weird stories going back to, you know, 1620 up to 2022, right? Looking to the future. I mean, people still encounter strange things here, just like we do all across the country. So.
All right, Peter, let's take some phone calls and continue talking when we come back. I want to talk with you about some modern witch legends that you can talk about, and also some creepy haunted sites that are out there that you know about: the Gilson Road Cemetery, the Ramtail Mill Complex, the Freetown State Forest as well. So we'll talk about all that and much more. Peter's back with us, so we will open up the phone lines as well. If you live in the New England area and you've got a haunted story or you have a question, jump aboard.